welcome to episode 18 of the Melody, Mystery, and Mayhem podcast.
Well, we have two exciting things to share with you all today.
Yes, and both of them have to do with the throat.
Yes, you heard my brother correctly, the throat. Annalise, do you want to tell our listeners what you swallowed last night?
I swallowed a marble.
Yes, a marble. And it was quite traumatic for all of us.
Rest assured, friends, the second announcement is much more pleasant.
Lord willing, we will be releasing a compilation CD with our friends, the Lockwoods.
We will let you know all the details, but we are hoping to release it at Christmas time.
Okay, enough discussion of throats for now.
It's time for our theme song, King Alfred's War Chant.
For the read aloud. Today, our daddy reads aloud Uncle David's nonsensical story about giants and fairies by Catherine Sinclair.
In the days of yore, children were not at all such clever, good, sensible people as they are now. Lessons were then considered rather a plague. Sugar plums were still in demand, holidays continued yet in fashion, and toys were not then made to teach mathematics, nor storybooks to give instruction in chemistry and navigation. These were very strange times, and there existed at that period a very idle, greedy, naughty boy, such as we never hear of in this present day. His mama and papa were, no matter who, and he lived, no matter where. His name was Master Notebook, and he seemed to think his eyes were made for nothing but to stare out the windows, and his mouth for no other purpose but to eat. This young gentleman hated lessons like mustard, both of which brought tears to his eyes, and during school hours he sat gazing at his books, pretending to be busy, while his mind wandered away to wish impatiently for dinner, and to consider where he could get the nicest pies, pastries, ices, and jellies, while he smacked his lips at the very thoughts of them. I think he must have been first cousin to Peter Gray, but that is not perfectly certain. Whenever Master Notebook spoke, it was always to ask for something, and you might continually hear him say, in a whining tone of voice,
"Papa, may I take this piece of cake? Aunt Sarah, will you give me an apple? Mama, do end me with the whole of that plum pudding."
Indeed, very frequently, when he did not get permission to gormandize, this naughty glutton helped himself without even leave. Even his dreams were like his waking hours, for he had often a horrible nightmare about lessons, thinking he was smothered with Greek lexicons, or pelted out of school with a shower of English grammars, while one night he fancied himself sitting down to devour an enormous plum cake, and all of the sudden it became transformed into a Latin dictionary. One afternoon, Master Notebook, having played truant all day from school, was lolling on his mama's best sofa in the drawing room, with his leather boots tucked up under the satin cushions, and nothing to do but to suck a few oranges, and nothing to think of but how much sugar to put upon them, when suddenly an event took place, which filled him with astonishment. A sound of soft music stole into the room, becoming louder and louder the longer he listened, till at length, in a few moments afterwards, a large hole burst upon the wall of his room, and there stepped into his presence two magnificent fairies, just arrived from their castles in the air, to pay him a visit. They had traveled all the way on purpose to have some conversation with Master Notebook, and immediately introduced themselves in a very ceremonious manner. The fairy Do-Nothing was gorgeously dressed with a wreath of flaming gas around her head, a robe of gold tissue, a necklace of rubies, and a bouquet in her hand of glittering diamonds. Her cheeks were rouged to the very eyes. Her teeth were set in gold. Her hair was of the most brilliant purple. In short, so fine and fashionable looking a fairy was never seen in a drawing room before. The fairy Cheech-All, who followed next, was simply dressed in white muslin, with bunches of natural flowers in her light brown hair, and she carried in her hand a few neat small books, which Master Notebook looked at with a shudder of aversion. The two fairies now informed him that they very often invited large parties of children to spend some time at their palaces, but as they lived in quite the opposite direction, it was necessary for their young guests to choose which it would be best to visit first. Therefore, they now had come to inquire of Master Notebook whom he thought it would be most agreeable to accompany on their present occasion. "In my house," said the fairy Cheech-All, speaking in a very sweet smile and soft, pleasing voice, "you shall be taught to find pleasure in every sort of exertion, for I delight in activity and diligence. My young friends rise at 7 every morning, and amuse themselves with working in beautiful garden of flowers, rearing whatever fruit they wish to eat, visiting among the poor, associating pleasantly together, studying the arts and the sciences, and learning to know the world in which they live, and to fulfill the purposes for which they have been brought into it. In short, all our amusements tend to some useful object, either for our own improvement or the good of others. And you will grow wiser, better, and happier every day you remain in the Palace of Knowledge." "But in the Castle Needless, where I live," interrupted the fairy Do-Nothing, rudely pushing her companion aside with an angry, contemptuous look, "we never think of exerting ourselves for anything. You may put your head in your pocket, and your hands in your sides as long as you may choose to stay. No one is ever even asked a question, that he may be spared the trouble of answering. We lead the most fashionable life imaginable, for nobody speaks to anybody. Each of my visitors is quite an exclusive, and sits with his back to as many of the company as possible, in the most comfortable armchair that can be contrived. There, if you are only so good as to take the trouble of wishing for anything, it is yours, even without turning an eye around to look where it comes from. Dresses are provided of the most magnificent kind, which go on themselves without your having the smallest annoyance with either buttons or strings. Games which you can play without any effort at all or thought, and dishes dressed by a French cook, smoking hot under your nose from morning till night, while any rain we have is either made of sherry, brandy, lemonade, or lavender water, and in winter it generally snows ice punch for an hour during the forenoon." Nobody need be told which fairy Master Notebook preferred, and quite charmed at his own good fortune in receiving so agreeable an invitation, he eagerly gave his hand to the splendid new acquaintance, who promised him so much pleasure and ease, and gladly proceeded in a carriage lined with velvet, stuffed with downy pillows and drawn by milk-white swans, to that magnificent residence, Castle Needless, which was lighted by 1,000 windows during the day and 1,000,000 of lamps every night. Here Master No Book enjoyed a constant holiday and a constant feast, while a beautiful lady covered with jewels was ready to tell him stories from morning till night, and servants waited to pick up his playthings if they fell, or to draw out his purse or his pocket handkerchief when he wished to use them. Thus Master No Book lay dozing for hours and days on richly embroidered cushions, never stirring from his place, but admiring the view of trees covered with the richest burned almonds, grottoes of sugar candy, and a lot of champagne, a wide sea which tasted of sugar instead of salt, and a bright clear pond filled with goldfish that left themselves to be caught whenever he pleased. Nothing could be more complete, and yet, very strange to say, Master No Book did not seem particularly happy. This appears exceedingly unreasonable, when so much trouble was taken to please him. But the truth is that every day he became more fretful and peevish. No sweetmeats were worth the trouble of eating. Nothing was pleasant to play at all, and in the end he wished it were possible to sleep all day, as well as all night. Not 100 miles from the fairy Do-Nothing's palace there lived a most cruel monster named the giant Snap-'em-up, who looked, when he stood up, like the tall steeple of a great church, raising his head so high that he could peep over the loftiest mountains, and was obliged to climb up the ladder to comb his own hair. Every morning regularly this prodigiously great giant walked round the world before breakfast for an appetite, after which he made tea in a large lake, used the sea as a slop basin, and boiled his kettle on Mount Vesuvius. He lived in great style, and his dinners were the most magnificent, consisting very often of an elephant roasted whole, ostrich patties, tiger smothered in onions, stewed lions, and whale soup. But for a side dish, his greatest favorite consisted of little boys, as fat as possible, fried in the crumbs of bread, with plenty of pepper and salt. No children were so well fed or in such good condition for eating as those in the fairy Do-Nothing's garden, who was very particular friend of giant Snap-'em-ups, and who sometimes laughingly said she would give him a license and call her own garden his preserve, because she allowed him to help himself whenever he pleased to as many of her visitors as he chose, without taking the trouble even to count them. And in return for such extreme civility, the giant frequently invited her to dinner. Snap-'em-up's favorite sport was to see how many brace of little boys he could bag in a morning. So when passing along the trees, he peeped into the drawing-rooms, without having occasion to get upon tiptoe, and picked up every young gentleman who was idly looking out the windows, and even a few occasionally who were playing truant from school. But busy children seemed always somehow quite out of his reach. One day, when Master No Book felt even more lazy, more idle, and more miserable than ever, he lay beside a perfect mountain of toys and cakes, wondering what to wish for next, and hating the very sight of everything and everybody. At last he gave us so loud a yawn of weariness and disgust that his jaw very nearly fell out of joint, and then he sighed so deeply that the giant Snap-'em-ups heard the sound as he passed along the road after breakfast, and instantly stepped into the garden, with his glass at his eye, to see what was the matter. Immediately, in observing the fat, large, overgrown boy, as round as a dumpling, laying on a bed of roses, he gave a cry of delight, followed by a gigantic peal of laughter, which was heard 3 miles off. And picking up Master No Book between his finger and thumb, with a pinch that very nearly broke his ribs, he carried him rapidly towards his own castle, while the fairy Do-Nothing laughingly shook her head as he passed, saying, "That little man does great credit. He has only been fed for a week, and is fat already as a prize ox. What a dainty morsel will he be! When do you dine today, in case I should have time to look upon you?" On reaching home, the giant immediately hung up Master Notebook, by the hair of his head, on a prodigious hook on the larder, having first taken some large lumps of nasty suet, forcing them down the throat to make him still fatter, and then stirring the fire, that he might be almost melted with the heat, to make his liver grow larger. On the shelf quite near, Master Notebook perceived the dead bodies of six other boys, whom he remembered to have seen fattening in the fairy's Do-Nothing garden, while he recollected how some of them had rejoiced at the thoughts of leading a long, useless, idle life with no one to please but themselves. The enormous cook now seized hold of Master Notebook, brandishing her knife with an aspect of horrible determination, intending to kill him, while he took the trouble of screaming and kicking in the most desperate manner, when the giant turned gravely round and said that, as pigs were considered as much greater dainty when whipped to death and then killed in any other way, he meant to see whether children might not be improved by it also. Therefore, she might leave that great hog of a boy till he had time to try the experiment, especially as his own appetite would be improved by the exercise. This was a dreadful prospect for the unhappy prisoner, but meantime it prolonged his life a few hours, and he was immediately hung up again on the larder and left to himself. There, in torture of mind and body, like a fish upon a hook, that wretched boy began at last to reflect seriously on his former ways, and to consider what happy home he might have had if he could only have been satisfied with business and pleasure succeeding each other, like day and night, while lessons might have come in as a pleasant sauce to his play-hours, and his play-hours as a sauce to his lessons. In the midst of many reflections, which were all very sensible, though rather too late, Master Notebook's attention became attracted by the sound of many voices laughing, talking, and singing, which caused him to turn his eyes in a new direction, when, for the first time, he observed that Fairy Teachall's garden lay upon the beautiful sloping bank not far off. There a crowd of merry, noisy, rosy-cheeked boys were busily employed, and seemed happier than the day was long, while poor Master Notebook watched them during his own miserable hours, envying the enjoyment with which they raked the flower borders, gathered the fruit, carried the baskets of vegetables to the poor, worked with the carpenter's tools, drew pictures, shot with bows and arrows, played at cricket, and then sat in the sunny arbors learning their tasks, or talking agreeably with each other, till at length, a dinner bell having been rung, the whole party sat merrily down with hearty appetites and cheerful good humor, to an entertainment of plain roast meat and pudding, where the fairy Teachall presided herself, and helped her guest moderately, as too much as was good for each. Large tears rolled down the cheeks of Master Notebook while watching this scene, and remembering that if he had known what was best for him, he might have been as happy as the happiest of these excellent boys, instead of suffering and weariness as he had done at the fairy Do-Nothing's ending in the miserable death. But his attention was soon after most alarmingly roused by hearing the giant snap him up again in conversation with his cook, who said that if he wished for a good large dish of scalloped children at dinner, it would be necessary to catch a few more, as those he had already provided would scarcely be a mouthful. As the giant kept a very fashionable hour, and always waited dinner for himself till 9 o'clock, there was still plenty of time, so with a loud grumble about the trouble, he seized a large basket in his hand and set off at rapid pace towards Fairy Teachall's garden. It was very seldom that Snap-em-up ventured to think of foraging in this direction, as he never once succeeded in carrying off a single captive from the enclosure. It was very seldom that Snap-em-ups ventured to think of foraging in this direction, as he never once succeeded in carrying off a single captive from the enclosure. It was so well fortified and so bravely defended, but on this occasion, being desperately hungry, he felt as bold as a lion and walked, with outstretched hands, straight towards the fairy Teach-All's dinner table, taking such prodigious strides that he seemed almost as if he would trample on himself. A cry of consternation arose the instant this tremendous giant appeared, and, as usual on such occasions when he had made the same attempt before, a dreadful battle took place. 50 active little boys bravely flew upon the enemy, armed with their dinner knives and looked like a nest of hornets, stinging him in every direction, till he roared with pain, and would have run away, but the fairy Teach-All, seeing this intention, rushed forward with a carving knife, and, brandishing it high over her head, she most courageously stabbed him in the heart. If a great mountain had fallen to the earth, it would have seemed like nothing in comparison with giant Snap-em-up, who crushed two or three houses to powder beneath, and upset several fine monuments that were to have made people remembered forever. But all of this would have seemed scarcely without mentioning, had it not been for a still greater event which occurred on the occasion, no less than the death of the fairy Do-Nothing, who had been indolently looking on at this great battle, without taking the trouble to interfere, or even to care who was victorious, but being also lazy about running away. When the giant fell, his sword came with so violent a stroke on her head that she instantly expired. Thus, luckily for the whole world, the fairy Teach-All got possession of immense property, which she proceeded without delay to make the best use in her power. In the first place, however, she lost no time in liberating Master Nobook from the hook in the larder, and gave him a lecture on activity, moderation, and good conduct, which he never afterwards forgot, and it was astonishing to see the change that took place immediately in his whole thoughts and actions. From this very hour, Master Nobook became the most diligent, active, happy boy in Fairy Teach-All's garden. And on returning home, a month afterwards, he astonished all the masters at school by his extraordinary reformation. The most difficult lessons were a pleasure to him. He scarcely ever stirred without a book in his hand, never lay on a sofa again, would scarcely even sit on a chair with a back to it, but preferred a three-legged stool, detested holidays, never thought of any exertion or trouble, preferred climbing over the top of a hill to creeping around the bottom, always ate the plainest food in very small quantities, joined the Temperance Society, and never tasted a morsel till he had worked very hard and got an appetite. Not long after this, an old uncle, who had formerly been ashamed of Master Nobook's indolence and gluttony, became so pleased at the wonderful change that, on his death, he left him a magnificent estate, desiring that he should take his name. Therefore, instead of being any longer one of the Nobook family, he is now called Sir Timothy Bluestocking, a pattern to the whole county round, for the good he does to everyone, and especially for his extraordinary activity, appearing as if he could do 20 things at once. Though generally very good-natured and agreeable, Sir Timothy is occasionally observed in a violent passion, laying about him with his walking stick in a most terrific manner, and beating little boys within an inch of their lives. But on inquiry, it invariably appears that he has found them out to be lazy, idle, or greedy, for all the industrious boys are in the parish and are sent to get employment from him, while he assures them that they are far happier breaking stones on the road than if they were sitting idly in a drawing-room with nothing to do. Sir Timothy cares very little for poetry in general, but the following are his favorite verses, which he has placed over the chimney-piece at a school that he built for the poor. And every scholar is obliged, the very day he begins his education, to learn them. Some people complain that they have nothing to do, and time passes slowly away. They saunter about with no object in view, and long for the end of the day. In vain are the trifles and toys they desire, for nothing they truly enjoy. Of trifles and toys and amusements they tire, for want of some useful employ. although for transgression the ground was accursed, yet gratefully man must allow, 'twas really a blessing which doomed him at first to live by the sweat of his brow.
Today's hymn is Oh, the Deep, Deep Love of Jesus. Sophia and I sing it with the Lockwoods.
Now, on to the latest installment of the life and adventures of Little Larry.
Hello, this is Violet Quill, on location again with Lucille and Larry.
Lucille, I deeply, deeply apologize about Larry. The ambulance came last time, and it was pure craziness. I know you had a difficult time explaining why Larry was choking himself.
It's okay, don't worry. Besides, he's fine now.
Yes. I'm feeling great. Never better. In fact, I could do 20 push-ups right now.
Hit the floor. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay. Well, when you're done exercising, Larry, let's chat. What do you want to be when you grow up?
An architect. I will build something even bigger than the Eiffel Tower.
Wow, that sounds a little ambitious and a bit prideful. Have you ever studied the Tower of Babel? Well, in any case, I hope you break a leg.
But I love my legs. Don't make me break them, please. But wait. On the other hand, I could break one leg so badly that it has to be amputated. And then I'd get a peg leg just like a pirate. How exciting. Pirates lead lives full of adventure. Okay, let's do it. Where's that old bat of mine?
Here, Lucia, right in the kneecap. Give it a good whack. Ow!
Oh, dear.
Ow. Ow.
Larry, she just meant good luck. That's what break a leg means.
Oh, so there's no pirates in my future?
No, Larry, no pirates. Okay, Lucille, what do you like to do?
I want to be an artist. Watercolors, sketching, pastels, illustrations, I love all of them.
That's amazing. I kind of guessed that, though, because actions speak louder than words, of course.
Actions can't talk. Or can they?
Well...
Because if they can, that means I have separate speaking devices that I never even knew about. Do my elbows sing when I flap them like a chicken? Are my feet reciting Shakespeare when I climb a tree?
Larry, you interrupted Violet. Can't you let anyone have a complete thought?
A complete thought? What a boring notion. Who has time for completion when there are so many things to begin? Sentences, card games, sword fights. Oh, sword fights! I must go retrieve my sword. My jumping actions just now shouted that there's a dragon lurking around in my backyard. So goodbye!
Well, I will try to catch up with Larry next time. Back to you in the studio, Bob.
Today's poetry recitation is Mayflies by Paul Fleischman. Your moment, Mayfly month. Your hour, Mayfly year. Your trifling day, our life. We're Mayflies just emerging, rising from the river, born this day in May. Birthday and dying day, this particle of time, this single sip of living, all that we're allowed. We're Mayflies by the millions. Fevered, frenzied, rushed. No redwood centuries to squander as we please. We're Mayflies swarming, swerving, rising high, then falling, courting on the wing, then mating in midair. We're Mayflies laying eggs, our final frantic act. Sun's low, light's weak. In haste we launch them down the stream. We're Mayflies lying, dying, floating by the millions on the very stream from which we sprung so very long ago. This morning, back when we were young.